Thank you for listening to the AT Tapes, a podcast from the Journal of Athletic Training. The goal of this podcast is to interview researchers and clinicians on current topics facing athletic trainers and discuss how we can utilize best practices to improve patient outcomes. My name is Lizzie Hibbard, and I will be your host for this podcast. Currently, I'm a faculty member in the athletic training program at the University of Alabama, and I have a research interest in shoulder and elbow injury prevention in youth overhead athletes. You can follow me on Twitter at EE Hibbard. Before getting started on today's episode, I wanted to remind everyone that all content from JAT is open access, meaning it is free of charge to all readers thanks to funding from the National Athletic Trainers Association. Today's guests are Dr. Pat McKeon and Dr. Luke Donovan, who were co-authors on the paper, A Perceptual Framework for Conservative Treatment and Rehabilitation of Ankle Sprains, an Evidence-Based Paradigm Shift, in the recent special issue of the Journal of Athletic Training on Ankle Sprains and Instability. Pat is an associate professor at Ithaca College, and his research focuses on functional alterations associated with lower extremity joint injury, specifically ankle instability. Our other guest, Luke, is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. His research interests include the utilization of an impairment-based rehabilitation model for the treatment of chronic ankle instability. Pat and Luke, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Lizzie. It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us, Lizzie.
So before we begin with the podcast today, I'd like to ask each of you to talk a little bit about why you became an athletic trainer and then your educational and career background. So Pat, let's start with you.
Okay, thanks, Lizzie. Well, I think one of the big things about it is I got interested in athletic training when I was in high school playing sports and sustaining multiple injuries through the process. And I started to work with my athletic trainer there. His name was Scott Ellis, who really turned me on to the idea that I could combine medicine and sports, which were really two of my loves at the time. So getting into that, I wound up wanting to pursue it as a major and went to Springfield College, where I majored in athletic training and graduated in 1997. And after getting out of there, I had worked for a couple years and realized that I wanted to go back to school to get my master's in sports healthcare from the Arizona School of Health Sciences. And after going from my master's and then working as an assistant athletic trainer at Canisius College and then clinical education coordinator at Marist College, I wound up pursuing specifically ankle sprain research with Jay Hurdle at the University of Virginia for my PhD. And since then, from finishing up at the University of Virginia, my wife, Jen McKeon, and I, who's also an athletic trainer and researcher, wound up going to the University of Kentucky, where we worked for 6 years as professors in the master's program there, as well as the doctoral program in rehabilitation sciences. And then now we're both at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York, where I serve as the clinical education coordinator for the athletic training program.
Thank you for that, and thank you for joining us today. So, Luke, let's go to you now. If you can tell us a little bit about why you became an athletic trainer and your education and career background.
Absolutely. So, similar to Pat, a lot of my interest came from enjoying sports and unfortunately having a couple injuries along my way. And the other side of it, though, is I've always been someone who's just been very curious about the how and why and how did you know that. So the first time that my athletic trainer was able to diagnose an injury without any sort of imaging or really any of these kind of fancy tools that you may see in all of these healthcare commercials, it really baffled me. And then as I start to pursue my career at Penn State University, I learned that way more about the actual profession of athletic training. And it just overtook me and consumed me as someone who's interested in the body, someone who's interested into medicine, and then also just someone who wants to help individuals. And at that time, I had never thought of a career in research. But then working with the great faculty members at University of Virginia, I found that the research process isn't quite as scary as people lead it on to be. So I kind of discovered that during my master's training. And then at that time, was fortunate enough to also study under Dr. Jay Hurdle. to pursue my PhD in sports medicine. After finishing my PhD, I then took my first education position at the University of Toledo, where I spent 2 years there, one of the year being a director of their graduate post-professional program. And at that time, I took the opportunity to take a position at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, and I'm currently at that position working as an assistant professor and teaching and doing research in both the athletic training program and then also their exercise science program.
Great. Thank you guys for introducing yourself to us and for taking the time to be with us today. So before we talk specifically about your paper and the perceptual framework for conservative treatment of rehabilitation of ankle sprains, I want to start talking a little bit more generally about why this special issue on ankle sprains was needed and the problems that exist currently with the conservative treatment of ankle sprains. So I think most athletic trainers would say that they've managed an ankle sprain conservatively, and overall their patients have been able to return to sport. However, we know that ankle sprains have really high reoccurrence, and some of these can lead to lifelong complications. So Pat, can you start off by talking to us a little bit about the current standard of care and what exactly isn't working, and what are these complications that we're seeing in these patients presenting following these seemingly simple injuries?
One of the big things that we know, athletic trainers see a lot of ankle sprains. And since the 2013 position statement that was put out by a group of authors, including Jay Hurdle and Tom Kaminsky, associated with how we conservatively treat ankle sprains and their recommendations, one of the other things that we started to really put together really is a better update on the prevalence of these injuries. And in the recommendations that they put out, which really represent the standard of care for right now, these include such things as the utilization of some form of bracing or taping, the utilization of some form of therapeutic exercise through the process of recovering from an ankle sprain, and then the potential for the use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories early on in the process for controlling pain and also some of the other aspects of the inflammatory response. One of the big things about it, though, is that we know that ankle sprains are really the most common injury that we see across all physical activity. And I think one of the big things about athletic trainers especially is that we certainly work with athletes and have great exposure to those who are sustaining an ankle sprain. But for the general population, we know that at least 50% aren't seeking out medical care for these types of injuries. And we know that the recurrence rates for these injuries are really high. And accompanying that, not only are the recurrence rates really high, but what's also very high is the development of a condition that we call chronic ankle instability, where a person goes on to have lifelong issues with their ankle that they've sprained, resulting in not only the idea that their ankle doesn't feel the way that it used to, but also they become less physically active over time. They report lower quality of life. They're more apt to develop such degenerative conditions as ankle osteoarthritis over the long term. And so while we as athletic trainers especially have a tendency to see patients at the high school and the collegiate and the professional levels, there's a really large chunk of the population that potentially we're not seeing. And I think that was the reason for updating the special issue for ankle instability.
So thank you for that. Luke, Pat talked a little bit about chronic ankle instability. Can you sort of go over the definition of how chronic ankle instability is defined and how we can evaluate this in our patients?
Absolutely. So, well, since the new model by Hurdle et al. Has just come out, I'm going to use their definition of chronic ankle instability. CAI is a condition characterized by repetitive episodes or perceptions of the ankle giving way, ongoing symptoms such as pain, weakness, or reduced ankle range of motion, diminished self-reported function, and recurrent ankle sprains that persist for more than 1 year after the initial injury. And how that's evaluated right now is we rely pretty heavily on some self-reported outcome measures, such as the Cumberland Ankle Instability Tool or the Identification of Functional Ankle Instability Tool, and then also the Foot and Ankle Ability Measure Scale. So usually how we define someone with CAI is by taking a patient history and then also incorporating some of these patient-reported outcomes. And in a clinical setting, though, is realistically, we define it based off of whether an individual is reporting a deficit in what they're trying to do. So we kind of have to look at this condition in both a research light and then also a clinical light, because realistically, even if someone doesn't score a certain percentage on some of these self-reported outcomes, however, they are seeking medical care with some sort of deficit, at that point, to me, yes, they are having some sort of chronic condition stemming from that original ankle sprain.
So in your paper in this special issue, you all proposed the use of the perceptual interdependence framework for this conservative treatment and rehabilitation of ankle sprains. And it is a little bit of a complex overview. So I would encourage everyone to go to the paper also that we will link to so that you can see some of the graphics that they included. But Pat, can you give us a little bit of an overview of what this framework entails and sort of each one of these elements that's included within it?
Sure, Lizzie. So as Luke and I had met at the last International Ankle Symposium, which was down at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, we had had a chance to talk through the idea of writing a paper for the special issue on ankle instability, specifically geared towards rehabilitation. And part of the process that we were working through is what's new with rehab with ankle instability, and how do we begin to advance potentially what we're doing? And specifically, as we discussed, one of the key things that was coming out was that when you looked at a lot of ankle sprain rehabilitation strategies, they really emphasized the motor output, the strength, the coordination, the balance exercises, those types of things, just from an output standpoint. But one of the things that I had been working on with Eric Wickstrom was the sensory targeted ankle rehabilitation strategies trial, or what we call the STARS trial, where we were utilizing the ability to drive sensory information into the system through the use of manual therapy techniques such as ankle joint mobilizations, plantar massage, and calf stretching. And what we found is as we targeted sensory information and augmenting sensory information in people with chronic ankle instability, they seemed to improve on some of the major outcomes of self-reported function and balance enhancements and increased range of motion that was independent of doing anything on the motor side. And that led us to say, well, maybe, you know, one of the original proposals for chronic ankle instability, in fact, the original was put out by Freeman in 1965, where he had thought that there was some type of sensory loss from injuring the ankle. And that sensory loss wound up manifesting itself as a problem with the ability to move appropriately, to control movements, to control the ankle, and then especially to control balance. And that idea of sensory information becoming important really paved the way towards us being able to say, you know, maybe we need to start looking more so at how the sensory system influences behavior as opposed to just simply trying to change behavior from a motor standpoint. So that was really the first framework that Luke and I had started to talk about. And then what we started to do too is look into some of the other theories that we had been exploring for a while. And the dynamic systems theory of motor control was definitely one that we've both explored, but especially from a coordination and balance training and gait standpoint, the idea that sensory information becomes so important for us to be able to perceive the constraints from the environment and the way that we go about performing a task, that really serves to shape the strategies that we have to accomplish a movement goal. And then on top of that as well, there's this theory referred to as the neuromatrix, or the body self neuromatrix, which is oftentimes found in pain control theory. And really what it is, it is that this idea of the body self neuromatrix is a neurological system that we have that combines sensory information, cognitive, and even emotional aspects of how we perceive ourselves. And looking at this idea of sensory information being important, both from a perceiving constraints that are acting on us, as well as allowing us to have a perception of our body self, we started to see how the body self idea of perceptual interdependence started to form, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so thanks for giving us that overview of the framework and sort of kind of the history of where it came from. So can you now talk a little bit about how someone could use this in clinical practice? So how does this framework drive rehabilitation decisions?
One of the things about that is when we think about a person who suffers an ankle sprain, early on, we know the major issues that a person is dealing with is pain and edema. Right? And that's usually what we target early on in terms of our therapeutic interventions. But one of the things that we Luke and I were putting out about this is that there's a shared dependence of perception from the cellular level all the way out to the societal level, in that the idea of an initial ankle sprain introducing mechanisms for pain and the inflammatory soup that's accompanied within the edema that really charges up that area, that alters sensory information, but that sensory information alteration also changes perception, which potentially leads to the manifestation of certain impairments, certain activity limitations, and even certain participation restrictions on the part of the patient. But as the person works through the rehab process, being able to choose certain interventions such as pain control and edema reduction become really important early on. But the other aspect about that is working towards restoring range of motion, not from a mechanical standpoint, but more so from a sensory perceptual standpoint through such things as joint mobilizations, even plantar massage, calf stretching, and just general active range of motion activities might help our ability to keep these individuals from falling into altered perceptual issues about where their ankle is in space, or about even the connection that they have with their ankle based on being a part of their body and, more importantly, a part of their selves. And then as you work through in terms of working towards enhancing range of motion, decreasing pain, decreasing edema, the other aspect about that that becomes important is how we choose to use balance training and other coordination training types of activities, which everyone is using basically now because it is part of the standard of care, but using it in a way of saying we can manipulate these exercises to promote an enhancement in the ability for the person to perceive themselves as being connected back to their ankle again.
So Luke, we talked a little bit about how you utilize this framework in clinical practice. Can you now talk about some of the best practice guidelines for clinicians as they're managing an individual with an acute ankle sprain?
Absolutely. And what I'd like to do is cue the readers into that last table within that manuscript. I'm going to reference that a few times to answer your question. But first, what I want to also address is that the understanding that the acute impairments that are present during that first ankle sprain, if they go unresolved, that carries forward into that chronic ankle instability individual. And that's actually been tested prospectively out of some work from Dr. Daugherty a few years back. And if we start to kind of match up all of our previous research over decades, we start to see that the impairments that show up in an acute individual are going to be very similar to the impairments that are showing up in an individual with chronic ankle instability. Now, there's not much clarity as to whether it's a true continuum, but it seems like, based off the evidence, that it very well may be a true continuum. So when we start to look at the best practices going from the acute to chronic ankle instability individual, what we really want to do is try to avoid the CAI altogether. And when we review a lot of the literature, what some of the acronyms that Pat had come up with is NICE and EASY. So there's been substantial literature to support early non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication, ICE, compression, and elevation. but the EASY stands for external ankle support for up to 1 year. And so from an acute standpoint, if we're just kind of zoning into that table, we can see that cell to tissue level. We can start to look at some of our main rehabilitation goals. And those are going to be like any other injury, reduce our pain, restore integrity of the damaged structures, also structures, control some inflammation. Previous research has found this nice and easy principle to work very well at doing that. But what we also propose is to also incorporate some of these perceptual concepts, pain management education, injury management education. It is okay to give the full education of what happens if we do not alleviate some of these impairments. And then as we continue to work out from the cellular level up to the tissue and the body level, then we can start to incorporate some of the STARS and resistive training that Pat had talked about earlier. And then as we work further away from the cell and going from body to self, again, coordination training has been shown to be very efficient at improving impairments associated with both acute and chronic ankle instability. But as we start to add on this perceptual component, maybe having someone just stand on an unstable surface isn't good enough, but we actually have to start giving some air-based progressions during these tasks. Some air-based progressions during some realistic sports scenarios, whether it's through virtual reality or other mechanisms, positive self-talk, all of these can start to be included in addition to our coordination training. And then finally, from the self-to-society level, again, the table calls it what it is. We're starting to get into some more exploratory areas. But the theory is going based off of, we're now going to take that individual with this ankle sprain and we're going to get them back into society. And at this time, their society might be working out with the team, interacting with their teammates and getting back into practice and even game situations. But it's very important to understand that the perceptual component of this rehabilitation progress doesn't end there. But we also have to continue to include that in our rehabilitation decisions.
So when you think about rehabbing someone from an acute ankle sprain, based off of the literature and what information is out there, what is the timeline for that? Typically, how long does a rehab last for an acute ankle sprain if you were following the best practice guidelines?
I think one of the biggest issues that we have, even from a self-society perspective, is when you look at especially what's presented in the special issue about the high amount of athletes who are returning the same day after an ankle sprain, and then you look at the standards that we have specifically for the recommendations of diagnosing, waiting 5 days to figure out what's been damaged and what hasn't been damaged, there's a disconnect in terms of what we know and what we don't know with regards to the problems that a person's gonna face. The other thing about that is that we also see a large amount of individuals who are reporting pain after an ankle sprain, that typically that's not a variable that we necessarily, or that's not an outcome that we're necessarily doing a good job assessing. And so with that, even though it's reported as a low level of pain, perhaps that low level of pain is enough to influence the perception overall within the body self to really change the landscape of how a person is able to move and engage in physical activity.
And I think as you guys talk about that pain management education or injury management education in the first level of your rehab, kind of in this perceptual interdependence framework, that's really important for clinicians because sometimes it's really hard to manage those expectations that patients have that they're going to be back that day or they're going to be back the next day from what they're seeing. Mm-hmm. But really educating them could make a big difference in their long-term outcomes.
One thing that I think is really important to come back to with that too is the perception of disability. And I think that's really where Luke and I tried to hit home going all the way back to 1965 when we look at originally when the biopsychosocial model was really formulated and introduced, the idea that Nagy had said that disability really is a manifestation of the perception of the patient, but also influenced by the perception of the stakeholders around the patient. And I think that's very much so important how we view ankle sprains in the way that oftentimes when we look at the return rate within a day after sustaining a sprain, we know that many people don't necessarily consider ankle sprains to be anything more than a benign hiccup along the way. But there's definitely, based on the recurrence rates and the incidence of chronic ankle instability that we're seeing and the prevalence at any snapshot in time, that they're far from benign types of injuries. And one of the things that Luke and I were talking about with there is that it becomes really important to have injury education for the patient and pain management education for the patient, but especially injury education for those stakeholders who are around the patient, the coach, the parents, the friends, the athletes who are on the team, who are all encouraging the athlete or the patient through their recovery.
So within this framework, is there any difference in the guidelines for rehab if you are beginning with, or if you're managing someone that has chronic ankle instability? So rather than an acute case walking in, you have somebody that's had this chronic ankle instability, do you still start at that first cellular level, or are there differences in best practice guidelines for somebody with chronic ankle instability?
Well, I think one of the key things that Luke developed was the impairment-based rehabilitation paradigm. And actually, when you look at that, I think it's really important when dealing with a person with chronic ankle instability, where they are in their own development and progression of the condition becomes really important. That it's not a one-size-fits-all mentality in terms of what interventions we can give them. Rather, Luke has done an outstanding job in terms of paving the idea of here's what to look for. Here are the most common impairments that we're likely to going to see, and here's the evidence-based intervention strategies that we have to address them. And within the perceptual framework especially, one of the things that we were putting out with that is where we might choose to use such things as coordination and balance training types of exercises. For a person with chronic ankle instability, it might become really important to spend time with them to explain to them that it's not just performing the exercise that's important. Just as Luke was saying before, we're manipulating the task and the environment to promote a sense of mastery about these activities. And that's where the figure one becomes really important in the paper, that as you look at where a person is, you can begin to design your strategies for intervention around them, as opposed to designing them around the intervention strategies that you plan to use.
Thank you very much for providing information today on your paper. As we finish up this episode, I'm going to ask each of you to provide your take-home message on how we can use this information to improve patient outcomes. So, Pat, let's start with you.
Right. So I think from a perceptual interdependence framework, the key take-home points are linking the behavior of the cell in the person who has an injured ankle all the way out to the society that they're going to return to. And key to that are some of the intervention strategies that we have, that early on, think about taking it nice and easy with your ankle sprain. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, ice compression, and elevation within the first 2 weeks. Moving on to having conversations about the utilization of external ankle support for up to a year. As pain and swelling are under control, as we start to get them under control, think about how you can begin to progress into some range of motion and coordination activities, with the goal, especially coordination activities, of cultivating a sense of mastery about them, and manipulate the constraints that we can do about that, as opposed to simply progressing to a next level that might not be relevant.
And Luke, can you give us your take-home message for the day?
Absolutely. Some of the things that I would say is specific to more of chronic ankle instability, and starting to think of it as more of a neuromechanical condition rather than just a peripheral condition. There's a lot of great studies coming out from Dr. Needle's lab, Dr. Rosen's lab, Dr. Burkle's lab, that are starting to show some of the cortical changes that happen in individuals with chronic ankle instability and even after an acute lateral ankle sprain. So starting to think about that as we develop these rehabilitation programs. And another take-home point that I would say is, if you're working with a patient with chronic ankle instability, it's perfectly okay to start working all the way back at the cellular level. understanding that many of these early on impairments are most likely still going to be present in this patient. And it's encouraged to actually start to work our way, almost reset the system and allow that system to readapt and then to then have a potential better outcomes. So
I appreciate you all joining us today and sharing your knowledge. Thank you for the work that you do to improve our profession and patient care. I hope you all have a great day.
Thank you, Lizzie, very much.
Thank you so much, Lizzie.
I hope you all found this podcast informative and that you can utilize the clinical recommendations to improve patient care. That's it for today's The AT Tapes. Please remember to rate and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Also, please follow the Journal of Athletic Training on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at JAT_NATA on all three platforms. Thank you for listening, and I hope you will join us for next month's episode of the AT Tapes. Thank you.